that I did in the last hour. So do you ever see my face look like when, you know, when your mask goes slow and it's like the rainbow wheel of death? Please offer me grace. My name is Rachel Gilson. I'm also back from a little bit in Boston.
Woo!
My husband is Shiloh. I serve on the National Theological Development Working Team under Pete Johnson, specifically giving leadership in the LGBT engagement. So some of you are type A and would like to know what we're planning on doing over the next hour together. So first, I'd like to tell you some of my story. I'd like to talk a little bit about what the Bible says, specifically a positive vision for God's words on sex and relationships. I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about how we can love LGBT people in our lives, and then spend a little bit of time taking questions. Now, we only have an hour together, so I promise that every single question or thought that you ever have this issue will be completely resolved by the end of the hour. I just want to congratulate you in advance on being an expert in just 60 minutes from now. Oh, goodness. So, like some of you in the room, I am not straight. And also, like some of you in the room, I did not grow up in a Christian household. So you might be wondering, how did I get here? I grew up in a very rural, conservative part of California. If you know those parts exist, they do. And my family were not church folks, like not even Christmas and Easter. So by the time I got to high school, I had developed a very particular image of what Christianity was, and it was not favorable. So on one hand, I thought of Christianity as being a crutch for people who didn't know how to take themselves. And I thought of myself as very intellectually capable, very worldly, very thoughtful, and I thought I'd be this, you know, silly little bully system, an invisible person, et cetera, et cetera. But the other thing that really troubled me about Christianity was that I knew that Christianity was against my sexuality. Even though I had never been mistreated by a church or by a Christian person, I understood that I was not welcome in Christianity because I wanted to marry a woman one day. I wanted to have girlfriends, not boyfriends. So in my mind, Christians were stupid dudes. Right? Not the kind of people you want to have marriage with. Right? Not the kind of people you want to spend time with. So my senior year in high school, I was accepted to Yale College, which is in Connecticut. And because I didn't know how bad Hoosier is, I went. Because I thought, here's a place where I can finally explore big ideas. Here's a place where I can finally explore my sexuality. And when I was there, I really built my life on these two pillars. One, my academic excellence, and two, this girl I was dating at the time, who I really worshipped, like the kind of fear and love you should only direct towards the Lord. And God in his kindness, when I showed up for that freshman fall, just blew those pillars apart. So, one, if you go to a crappy public high school, you will not be the most impressive person in any of you. I have a continual identity crisis with why am I suddenly one of the stupidest people in this room. My girlfriend, who I adore. It's a little bit embarrassing to tell you this, but I need to be honest with you, okay? So she took a year off of college to go work in Lake Tahoe because she came from a ship, whatever. And she left me. She left me for a man who hadn't graduated high school, who lived in a van. And not even a van that worked properly, like you had to get it rolling down a hill first to get it into the cage. Like, this is embarrassing. No one wants to be left with this man, right? So that pillar just crumbled, dust everywhere, right? So Yale has this policy where they don't let you stay in the dorm over Christmas break. You have to go somewhere. I guess they clean it or something. I don't know. But I had been kicked out of my house, which is a different story. The only place I had to go over Christmas break was with my now ex-girlfriend. So I spent my freshman year, Christmas morning, reading Don Quixote on the futon, hearing her have sex with her new boyfriend in the other room, and thinking, this is the worst Christmas ever. You can laugh more, right? It was bad, right? And so I didn't know what to do anymore. I was really in an identity crisis. So I went back to Yale, and I was like, gosh, what am I going to do? Maybe I could write the school newspaper, except I'm not smart enough to write the school newspaper, or maybe I could go to the gym more, except I'm way too lazy to go to the gym more. So I was just casting around. But I never thought, oh, I should turn to Jesus. Never once. I was not interested in Jesus. So I happened to be sitting in a lecture one day, an auditorium, so I said, and we were working our way through the Western philosophers. And one day we were talking about this old dead European who invented the phrase, I think therefore I am, can be heard. And from this phrase, he invents this whole proof for the existence of God. And when I was sitting in the lecture, I was thinking, this is a really stupid proof for God. And actually, I still don't think it's great. But while I was sitting in the audience, there was kind of this thought that began to gather of like, well, what if there is a God? And I was like, no, we don't think that. That's how stupid it is. But it's like, well, you haven't thought about it in a while. Maybe you should, you know, go up a little bit. And I was like, no, yes, no, yes. So being a good millennial, I asked the internet. So this was in 2004 when you still needed two hands to open your laptop. So I was, you know, try opening my window and just fired in religious assertions, you know? Who even knows what I was coming up with? But I kept coming back to the person of Jesus. I was weirdly drawn to Jesus, which I did not like. My vision of Jesus was like George W. Bush wrapped in toga, which as I was interacting with these stories about Jesus, there was this really appealing thing where you could tell these people who didn't like him would come and give him a tricky question, and he would just shut them down. And I loved it. I was like, God, this is awesome. So I don't know if that's like a character deficiency in me, but I appreciate that part of Jesus, but I just want to be honest with you all. But then there was this other part of Jesus where he was incredibly tender and vulnerable with the kind of people who I would not have given any thought to, or worse, would mock. So there was just something compelling about who he was, and I couldn't quite shake it. So the only two people I knew in Yale who identified as Christians were these two women who were dating each other, and one of them was trained to be a Lutheran minister, so I thought, perfect, right? Like, they will definitely tell me what's up. And yes, I met them in the marching band, and no, never in my life been cool. So as a finite, you know, they were. So I think of these things as unreconcilable, but clearly y'all figured something out. They're like, oh yeah, it's all been a big misunderstanding. God is totally supportive of a non-same sex relationship. I was like, oh, okay. And they gave me this packet of information. I love packets. So I took that thing back to my room. And I was working through it, and it had a real internal logic that I understood. And I was even getting excited about it. Oh, maybe there's something here for me. But when I pulled up on my computer the Bible verses, it was purporting to explain, reading, and I was like, oh no, I don't think these things match. Like, I'm good at almost nothing. One of the only things I'm good at is reading. I was not on the Bible stock. I was like, dang, I think David has a woman problem, not a man problem. You know? Not long after that. And she was a non-practicing Catholic, or as I learned later, But I didn't want to ask her for it because I was embarrassed to admit that I was interested. So I just stole her.
This point of like, oh, well, I can obey if I agree and understand.
And there's a way that the Lord had impressed me and said, hey, if you're only willing to obey and you agree and you understand, how does that not make you God? It actually reminded me a lot of this story I had just learned about two people put into a garden. So God created Adam and Eve and put them in this beautiful place. And the Bible never says Eden was perfect. It's not in the text, right? It wasn't perfect. We're not going back to Eden. We're going forward to New Heaven and New Earth. He still set them in this good place. And he gave them one rule. And we could think, like, wouldn't it make sense? God says, all right, children, here's your one rule. Don't kill each other.
He's proven so many ways that he is for us.
arbitrary, or they can feel cruel. We know his character is not arbitrary or cruel. I mean, sometimes when we understand the purpose of something, it helps us understand the ways the nose, the way it's not supposed to be used. So there's a story I love to use to illustrate this, just because it makes me laugh. So indulge me here. But I've got a friend, Sam, who has a buddy. His buddy loves to have people over to his house. And he moved into a new apartment one day, and he's looking through the things that were left. And in one of his drawers, there was this spoon that had a perfect hole in it. Like, you know a spoon, it's got like a lever, and the whole point is that there's like this bowl on the end. But there's just a hole, like you could make a scoop with it, you couldn't do anything with it. So you're like, what is this stupid spoon? Well, it wasn't rusted out, it was like designed that way. So he decided to put it in his sugar bowl. Because he's British, and so there was making tea for people. And so what he would do is he would invite his guests to, you know, serve themselves some tea, and he would kind of stand over and watch them try to use that spoon and sugar bowl. Right? So they would go over and they'd open the lid and panic. Because they see that the spoon is not sufficient. So some of them would try to like pick up a little sugar by the rim and just flick it into the cup really. He claims that Americans would loudly complain, "Oh, you have a stupid spoon," you know. I don't know if that's an accurate representation of us, but still. One day, he had a friend come over, open up the jar, and pull out the spoon and say, "Why do you have an olive spoon in your sugar bowl?" And he was like, "Oh, what?" Yeah. So, do you know how olives are sold in those long jars of disgusting liquid? So, there's this spoon, you can reach into the liquid, and the hole is big enough, like it's small enough so the olive doesn't fall through the hole, but all the juice runs off. So if you have this handy tool, you can reach into the nasty jar, drain out the disgusting liquid, eat your yucky olive. I think olives are disgusting. I don't know why you have a process. But still, the purpose of the spoon helps you figure out how to not use it like fool. And I think there's a way when we get a vision for the purpose God has for marriage and sexuality, it helps us understand the way it's supposed to be used. So when we're reading the scriptures, it's really easy to see that every place where sex is being practiced in a holy and good way, it's connected with marriage. So we can't ask the question, what is sex for, without asking the question, what is marriage for? And in fact, I think when we look at the scriptures, those of you who are notators, I think we see four different good things that God has built into marriage so that it can serve its one purpose. And you're all wondering, what is the purpose of marriage? I'm so glad you asked. So the purpose of marriage, I believe, is to communicate the gospel. It's designed to be a living, breathing, running around picture of God's relationship with his people. So that in every culture, in every place, there's this image, this theme that reflects and refracts the gospel back to humanity. That's not the only picture. Parents and children can get a picture, friendships can get a picture, but there's a way that God loves this metaphor of marriage to communicate about who he is and who his people are and what their relationship is. And so each of the four things directly relates to God communicating that one message. And where those things get broken or interrupted, it interrupts the message God is trying to communicate. So we start with those two and we're done to waste. So one, God has designed marriage to be faithful and enduring for all of life because God's relationship with his people is faithful and forever. I think a lot of us talk about that experience of seeing a really cute old couple holding hands on a greeting card or something, and thinking, oh, that's what I want, right? This vision of a love that lasts, that endures, that plays out, is beautiful in part because it echoes that God's never going to leave us. That we are always going to be with him. And that it's faithful. Communicates that God has eyes for us and that we should have that only eyes for him. Right, and so just to ask a little rhetorical question. destruction. If we think about faithful endurance, who do we think has done more damage to the vision of marriage around us? Straight people or not straight people? We've got to understand that all of us in this room are sexually burdened. And that as we walk through the good things that God has built, they're all implicated in not living up to what He's created, to what He set up. And that all of us need grace and forgiveness and help in living out this inner journey. So number one, we've got faithful endurance. Number two, marriage is supposed to be a place of sexual pleasure. It's not like we invented sex. God is the one who invented our bodies. He designed them to do the things that they do. He didn't look down one day and clutch his pearls and think, oh no, I need to regulate this yucky thing they invented. The joys and pleasure of marital love. Song of Solomon. I heard that Orthodox Jewish men aren't even allowed to read this book until they're 40, which is confusing for me because when I read, your teeth are like a flock of goats. It's hard for me to connect to that erotically, but still. I understand that that's part of it. And even if you are not married, your sexuality still serves its purpose. It still serves like a homing beacon inside of you to communicate truths about God. But sometimes our sexual desire is so strong and so enduring, it can take up our whole windshield. But part of that communicates how much God longs for us and how much we should long for Him, or our sexuality is never wasted, even if we don't happen to be in a marriage at a given point. It still communicates something really beautiful. And again, we have to ask, oh, who has broken this good thing more, even just statistically? Is it straight people or is it not straight people? The ways we can use sex selfishly, the ways we can abuse others with sex, the ways some of us have been abused with sex, the ways our churches have covered up. There are deep, deeply broken and sinful things going on here. It's not how God designed it. Right? No human being good. But we so often return these good things for evil. It doesn't change God's purposes for it. We see we live in brokenness. So one, we've got faithful endurance. Two, we've got sexual pleasure. You thought it'd be good to encourage you, right? Talking about the goodness of sex and bring forward to that. Anyway. And then three, another good gift that God has designed to exist in marriage is procreation. It's an amazing thing that part of how we image God is that we can use our bodies to create brand new life. I mean, think about it. On a bad night, in 3 minutes, you can create a being who will never stop existing. All of us can participate. All of us have access to motherhood and fatherhood, to our culture says that marriage is only defined by those three things. Actually, really, the first two, procreation, really only if you like kids, you can afford them. Some people only have friends, like dogs, I don't know. And so this is where we can get short-circuited a little bit, because obviously two men can have deep companionship and sexual pleasure together. Obviously two women can have those things. And they can even bring children into their households and raise them in nurture and safety. And so if that's all we ever said marriage is, no wonder we feel a little flat-footed. We kind of don't know where to go with it. Additionally, culture has said that you're not a real or full adult unless you have a romantic partner. And in the church, you just baptize that a little bit and say, unless you're married. I cringe for us sometimes when I realize we've bought into this weird, unbiblical lie where if you're a good little boy or girl, God will guarantee give you a spouse and you will have perfect sex forever. That is unbiblical and unhelpful. But we've kind of truncated what marriage is, and then we've also blown it up as this reward for faithfulness. That's not a reward for faithfulness. It's certainly not a finish line. For some of us, it's just a starting line. You recognize, right? Most of us will not, most of us who are married are not going to die in our bed at the same moment our spouse holding hands, right? Like, singleness is not some uniform period of life, or it's not some little thing that just happens in your 20s. Oh God, we'll be in your 30s. Singleness is actually the default stage for humans. Singleness is actually exalted in the scriptures, varsity level, and marriage is good. But kind of JV by the time we get to the new covenant, but our culture is swamped with that. We've created something untenable. I saw someone online the other day referred to it as the sexual prosperity gospel, and I was like, oh, yeah, that's real. I didn't know that. I forgot her name, but it's great. But we've got this other good marriage that I think helps us understand it a little bit more. And for some of us, it's not going to be able to do it. And I know that. But all through the scriptures, we see that this fourth good is sex difference. That is, that marriage involves female and male. Just imagine male right here, right? Female and male. So why do God build this in marriage? For some of us, we don't feel this is intuitive. Well, some of it is that God's trying to show a love across difference, a taking of two things that are different and being able to unite them. Now, sometimes we overplay our hand with the differences of men and women. We've taken mid-20th century stereotypes and declared that those are the biblical man and the woman and the child. But we do know that God created male and female good, and that in the context of marriage, it's shown something like, hey, these are different parties, equally human, but fundamentally different, and that there's unity here. God is much more different from us than male and female are different. It's still part of the picture. And also what we see by having these two different parties is you need both for the picture to work. You have a party, God is always the male in the image, and his people are always female in the image. They're not interchangeable. You need both of them. And I think this is really interesting to think about the metaphor from Genesis to Revelation, because God is not uncomfortable with using feminine descriptions of himself when he needs to. There are times when he talks about nursing Jacob at his breast, or carrying Israel in his womb, or sort of fretting over his children. That promise in Isaiah, like, could a nursing mother forget her child? Even her mother will never forget you. And part of the reason he does this is because a mother is an accurate representation of the kind of love God has for us. But of course, in scripture, he normally refers to himself as male, and out of politeness, we should use his preferred pronouns. Yeah. But then something else that he I think is really telling. In the Old Testament, he is a faithful husband, and his people are an unfaithful bride. Y'all haven't had a quiet time in Ezekiel 16 recently. No, there's some imagery there. But then seeing the New Testament, because of the work of Christ, so many people are able to be beautiful. That all of us there will be single and all of us will be married. And that both of those states here are communicating something about what God's going to do. We're all going to be the brides of Christ. If there are any men who are comfortable there, just remember that we women are the sons of God. So it all works out. So we see that marriage has to be all four of those things. But think about it. Probably all of us know marriages that have sex difference and yet are so broken in those other three places that certainly they do not communicate God's good news. Certainly more marriages just in numbers than some marriages that actually have the first three pretty well and are actually just broken on the fourth. Okay, so we all share this thing together. There's no room to be haughty. I just want to encourage us, too, to think about what it means to be single in a church culture that is constantly catering to families. Like, no matter your orientation, but especially for those of us who experience same sex attraction or single, who could have partners who are choosing not to for the glory of Christ, that life says powerfully, I believe in the resurrection, and I'm willing to stake my whole life on it. How can we not draw near to that? How can we not honor that? And yet we've created spaces that are so unwelcoming. We've often thought, hey, if I just have my doctrine okay, how could it possibly matter how I treat people? We remember, of course, that Jesus rebuked the doctrinally perfect, self-righteous religious elite of his day with the story of the Samaritan. The Samaritan was a heretic. The Samaritan was theologically wrong. But he did justice and mercy in a way that reflected God, and Jesus said, go and do likewise. He's not telling them to become a heretic doctrine. He's saying, shouldn't those of us who have the doctrines of God be the most merciful, be the most loving? We have to reckon with the fact that the way the church has related to LGBT people has not been loving. Has not been the call to receive relationship, but instead has been a stiff arm. There are still kids today in 2019, I'm not saying 1989 or 99 or 2009, I'm saying 2019, who are coming out to their Christian parents saying, I'm attracted to people of my same sex, maybe they use the word gay, but it's scary for some of us in the room. And their parents are taking them out. Their parents aren't holding money for college. I have a friend, Bill, who ministers in this space, and he likes to say, the gospel of exclusion has no power to save an already banished people. Mm-hmm. But there's, that's Bill's one, it's not mine. But there's just something very real about it. We cannot consistently push people out and expect them to understand that there's a God who loves them. So, you might be thinking, well, where do I go? How do I relate? How do I love? There's not going to be four things. These also come from Bill Henson, his excellent resource called Guiding Families of LGBT People. Just four ways that we can begin or continue to love LGBT people in our lives. So, number one is invite. We want to invite our gay, lesbian, and transgender friends and families and acquaintances into our lives. So yeah, invite them to church, invite them to crew stuff, but also invite them into your life. Invite them over for dinner. Invite them out for coffee. Invite them to hang out with you and your kids. Invite them to work on a project you're working on. Just invite. How can we love people that we're not even near? We're not even inviting for an agenda. We know God's called to love our neighbor. We know there's a survey done. 9 out of 10 non-Christians were polled on the word that they would use for Christians. Not her, sorry, people were polled. 9 out of 10 non-Christians said the word that they thought was homophobic. We need to invite. But second, we also need to listen. to me, I was like, hey, give us a group background. What's that been like? Ask about their hobbies, ask about their work, ask about their significant other. If you have a relationship that's safe, that's trusted, you could ask them about, hey, what's your experience been being out in the world? What's it, when did you first discover that? How has that been for you? You're not asking so you can come down with the Bible. Asking to learn. You're listening in order to love. And I think in this way, too, it's really helpful when we've got, especially non-Christian friends. I try not to bring up the question of sexuality unless they bring it up. I mean, I don't want to share the gospel as often as I can. But there's not a person in the world who need to agree with God and change their life before they are allowed to accept the gospel. Right? And so we don't offer that opportunity to our LGBT friends. We're being unbiblical, we're being hypocritical. There's not a single non-Christian gay person in your life whose problem is that they're gay. Their problem is that they are not reconciled to the one who made them.
Separation.
to fly to extinction. Might not be what you mean, but that's how it's received, right? These missionaries who care about how language is received. So Rosario Butterfield, who writes in this area, likes to say, how about we sub in the phrase, love the sinner, hate my own sin? Which I think is a pretty good swap, actually. And for some of you, like some of you working in Canvas, you might have the opportunity to protect, even in ways like with your student groups, you partner together with LGBT clubs on campus to work towards things that promote the dignity and safety of LGBT people. You don't have to compromise about how to do that. You might partner just go up and be like, hey, what do you care about? Because we care about what you care about. There's all kinds of things, like a charter project to help reduce LGBT suicidality. I mean, like, we can get involved with people not taking their own lives. I read this article that came out in HuffPost in 2017 by a non-Christian gay man who was writing about why are we still so lonely? How did so much progress been made? He was doing different interviews. He was interviewing a woman who worked at an AIDS clinic. And he was talking about how there's still so many gay men there. And she said, it's not a question of them knowing how to save their lives. It's a question of them knowing whether their lives are worth saving. We have to understand that there's still so much vulnerability. Now, your LGBT friends are not just piles of sadness, okay? But we have to understand that there's vulnerability. There's vulnerability, especially for youth, and especially for trans people, and especially for trans people of color. And what we see in the Gospels is that Jesus draws near to the vulnerable and is gentle with them, and his harsh words are for religious self-righteous people. We need to be people who are like Christ. So we want to invite, we want to listen, we want to protect, and we also want to invest. The gay, lesbian, transgender people in our lives, we want to invest in them so that they can flourish, whether or not they're Christians. But especially if they come to Christ. I mean, there are, I am not the only staff person who experiences this, right? We are already on mission. We are already on mission to serve the Lord. But a lot of us are doing so completely quietly because we're afraid that we'll be misunderstood, are afraid that we have to be looked into, afraid that there will be suspicions. What instead gave those who are making an insane cost to follow Christ and say no to their flesh were invested in, that their gifts were invested in, their opportunities were invested in, their whole person were invested in. It would be a beautiful thing. And wouldn't LGBT people outside the church, outside the crew, look in and say, oh, maybe that could be good news for me. Maybe that life with Jesus and his people looks plausible instead of insane. I mean, we have to hear, the church has done so much damage here, decades worth, and it's still happening. We're not going to turn the tide just based on one side of our time, right? Mm-hmm. But we do have an opportunity to share the gospel through renewed love in grace and truth. We have an opportunity to do something new, bathed in who Christ is. You know, there's ways that the culture is scary right now. It can seem to some of us like it's getting darker, but God has promised that the gospel is a light. And we all know that when things are darker, light shines better. We all know that he has promised to use the weak things of the world. So if you feel like I've got nothing to offer, excellent. Right? Because then he gets bored. So I don't want you to be discouraged. God is not giving us a spirit of fear, but power and love and self-control. He will be with us in this. He will help us with this. No matter where you're at, right? We can step forward. We can do this together. And we need each other in it. I'm going to do this thing where I check my clock to see if we have time for questions, right? When is this supposed to end? 3:45? Oh my gosh. All right, let's take a couple questions. We'll just stay here. We'll do the prayer.
So So add that to conversation on campus, random evangelism, guy just, what about homosexuality, what about, so I walked through biblical perspective of sexual purity and sex not outside of marriage, shared my own story of being young and being sexually permissive my first year of Christian life, total disaster, sexuality. But where I got stuck was marriage. And saying, so it's like, okay, if God's design is only for sex and marriage, why are you against marriage for two people of the same sex? And so you've given me a thought that I haven't had before that I think is good. It's a demonstration of the gospel, it's a demonstration of differences becoming unified. I think I could explain that to someone, but at least as I sit here, if I'm in the other seat, that's not, at least my initial thought is that's not convincing. That doesn't, hey, they're telling me that's the reason it's wrong?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think there's very much a reality behind, like, the sex different thing doesn't feel intuitive and beautiful to us already. So I'm not going to expect someone to be like, oh, yeah, now I get it. Maybe they could. I don't know. God has done weirder things, I guess. But I think that's why when we've got someone who's stuck on this issue, we want to understand why. You know, be like, hey, that's a really important question. Can I ask, like, why is it so important to you? And why we don't necessarily want to go into, like, a description of what marriage is, but I try to just go into a description of who Jesus is. Because even if I convince someone that God's sexual ethic is good and beautiful, but they don't experience reconciliation with God, what have they really gained? You know? So I think there's a way to not smoke and mirror, but to say, like, hey, God's sexual ethic is hard for everybody who follows him. I actually think it only makes sense when we know who he is. Could I tell you more about who he is? And sometimes they'll tell you no, right? But you're at least trying to demonstrate that there's a priority in how this conversation happens. We want to bring it back to the person of Christ. And I think when they understand that, even the less intuitive places start to click of like, but he's doing something and he's good. And how do I relate to that? Because for those of us who experience same-sex attraction, the discipleship can be really hard. How many of us often feel like you want to follow a particular rule, right? Like, there's places where we disagree with God, we don't like what he says, but when we love him and know him, that's when we're able, I think, to better draw near and say, okay, so what do I do with the things that still feel difficult? It's gotta be in a relationship first. All right, great.
Thank you. Do you have anything to say specifically to the staff members who are here, who are gay or same-sex attracted, or dealing with gender dysphoria in an organization that oftentimes is really painful, even people who mean well? Do you have anything you would say to those of us?
Yeah, is there, like, I know it's not just being brand, right? There are those ones in the room where this is a part of our journey. And sometimes it's been a really painful journey. Some of us have had great experiences. Some of us have had really hard experiences. I mean, I literally was rejected from staff when I applied because I was honest on my application. Mm-hmm. And now I'm graduating from Sarah. That's a funny joke. So, on some level, you don't owe anybody your story. But I do think it's really hard for us to thrive on our own. So if you haven't gotten to a place, I would urge you to share with same people, to figure out how to help make us more visible. Not because you owe it, just because I don't think I would make it without the community who knew. I want to get to a place where, like, I could share a prayer request that's related to my sexuality that was not even a big deal. You know what I mean? Where it's just like, it's just a normal prayer request or whatever, and it doesn't make anybody uncomfortable. And I think that starts with some of us taking risks. But not all of us are called to take those risks, right? Like, if crew has become a place that's uncomfortable for you, it's not like we're the only organization doing what the Lord's doing. Right, and a few other places, but I also want some of us to stay and to serve and to help make it a place that's full of grace and truth. And a place where
lots of us, not just saved married people like me, who are meant to serve. And I think too, if you've got a question about that, please like send me an email. I'd love to connect with you.
Is this recorded? And if not, can you come back to Seattle with me so I can hang out with you?
I think it's recorded. I don't know. I have really technical things. Yeah, I'd love to go to Seattle. So I'll come over now. So I have my ticket to Nashville tomorrow. Oh, yeah, I can try some plans.
Okay, what happened with the band?
What?
What happened with the band? It's a joke.
With my marching band? Yeah, I wasn't very good. I wasn't great.
Okay. If we are really bad with that, I totally agree with you. If we need to approach in a better way, I just thank you guys. Thank you for that. But I think the sexuality, we have with my wife, we have a lot of problems before. We don't Christ. I think what you say is for being together and being with God in the marriage. That's the first thing. And the second, the procreation. You say only in 2 minutes, 3 minutes, or something, in 2 minutes, but the thing is, I think is that when we approach them, all people, I think if we try to get them to the cross, I think God can change the way everything. Until is you have sexual affinity with a woman to woman and man to man. I think the same thing we are, everybody has problem. God can put it in order, everything. I think with the growth, with the cross, if we go to the cross, God can do it, everything.
So sort of like you're addressing the topic of whether or not God can change some of the things that limitations.
Yes.
Yeah, so God absolutely can provide change in orientation. I had a girl named Emily who grew up in an atheistic household, completely attracted to women, totally supported by her family, randomly and sort of became a Christian, fell in love with Jesus. And a couple of years into her walk, without her even asking, she now is completely attracted to men. Also, she spent 10 years like this single, so she's like, well, what's even the point of that? But, you know. So, yeah, sometimes God changes people's orientation. However, it's functionally miracle when that happens, and we know that miracles don't happen often. Sometimes God will choose to do that rarely, and it demonstrates his power over the natural world. So, okay, that happens. However, we do have a history in the church of trying to convince people that they should become straight, as if being straight is a command in scriptures, which it's not. There is no command to be straight. There is a command to be faithfully single or faithfully married, and you don't have to be straight to be faithfully married to one person. Marriage is not going to be for most of us who experience same sex attraction. Similarly, most of us are not going to experience a change in orientation. There's decades of research of thousands of people who are desperately in love with Jesus, who tried everything from shock treatment to behavioral therapy to make themselves straight, and it didn't happen. Sometimes I think rather God allows us to continue to experience this part of orientation because it can be a gift to the church. The church doesn't know how to say no to desire. Right? We don't know how to do that part of sanctification. The church doesn't know the beauty of what it is to say, yes, Seth and Roman are good. I could only say no because Jesus is more beautiful. So he can demonstrate his power by changing people, but I also think he more powerfully says how beautiful and worthy he is when he does not, and people follow him anyway. Oh my gosh. All right, we can take one more. I haven't had any women.
Right here.
Yeah, right here.
Okay. As I engage with middle school, junior high, and high schoolers, my intention.
Bless you.
Thank you. My intention in this whole arena is that sometimes, you know, they're not at a developmental age to be able to make decisions of gender, changing my gender, sexuality, and or even spiritual maturity enough to go, you know what, if this is who I am, I'm going to surrender this. So I think I feel stuck sometimes, like thinking I'm totally agreeing with what culture says, because that's what they're ingesting. So I'm wondering, like, how do you walk both these sides of, yes, I want to love you and I want you to belong, and yet what you're being fed is contrary to what, you know, what God is saying, yeah, in some cases, you know.
Yeah. Kind of. Well, and so this is why I work with college students, you know. and even as a mother, like, my daughter is 5 and a half, so I know approximately nothing. But I do think, so there's a couple things that are coming to mind. One is, there used to be a way that those of us in the church would just not talk about sex, or you would just, like, leave a weird book in the kids' room or something, and do that. Or I've heard weird stories, I don't know. Well, the church folk did some interesting things. So I do think we have to take into account, like, where are these precious image bearers, like, what can they handle? Which I think is why it's good to, like, just be in them, like, what language are they using? How can we pull a Tim Keller on them, right? Because here's what Tim Keller's good at. He says, yes, no, yes. So when he's turning to a non-Christian, he figures out what can he affirm. Because every human being is made in the image of God. And so the things we desire, the things we fear, the things we hope for, all ultimately connect to something God is doing to us. But then he says, no, not like, no, these things are invalid, but the ways we try to get there apart from God always come up short. But that in Christ and what he's done, not just like a simplified picture, but the totality of what Christ is doing in his righteousness, we actually see the answer to what we desire. So, like, that would have to be in language for a 12-year-old, right? Again, I do not hang out with a lot of 12-year-olds. So just, but I think that there's ways. They're entering this stuff in the culture really early. My daughter's going to go into kindergarten in the fall, and the best kindergarten teacher ever called at school is a woman married to another woman. It's like, I can't wait to have this conversation. But there's ways we can talk about who God is and the good things he's designed. So we're not putting down other people, but we're just saying, look at this goodness God's built. So we don't have to denigrate anybody, because we're all just looking for goodness. But trying to fish it back to him, that might be a little bit of an incomplete answer, but part of my hope and my belief, I feel sure actually that it's through Gen Z that God's going to give some of the best answers to these questions and respond, like, to do a new thing. So I think it's important for us to come around and understand, like, I think they're going to be the ones that God uses to fix a lot of what we've broken. And so can you come alongside them and help them and protect them and invest in them so that we don't despise the answers that we give, but that we hear the Lord through them too. So thank you for coming.